Fellow risk takers, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stotz from A. Stotz Academy. And today I'm continuing my discussions with Larry Swedrow, who is head of financial and economic research at Buckingham Wealth Partners. You can learn more about his story at episode 645. Larry has a deep understanding of the world of academic research, about investing, and particularly about risk. Today, we're going to discuss two chapters from his book, Investment Mistakes Even Smart Investors Make and How to Avoid Them. And we're going to be covering mistake number 28 and 29. Number 28 is, do you rely on a fund's descriptive name when making purchase decisions? And mistake 29, do you believe active management is a winner's game in inefficient markets? Larry, take it away.
Yeah, so the problem for investors is here, they tend to rely on the name of a fund and its descriptive value. So they'll look at a small cap fund and they assume the fund invests exclusively in small stocks or mid caps or large. Same thing through when we look at value versus growth stocks. But the SEC allows a sufficient amount of leeway that you can have dramatic differences because a large cap value fund can own some small cap growth stocks. And so you're not getting the asset allocation you think you're getting and you desire. And that's especially true, of course, of active managers who have freedom to roam. And as we've discussed in the past, the vast majority of returns are explained by your asset allocation to these common risk factors we've been talking about in our series, mainly size and value, as well as then profitability, quality, and momentum. So if you think you want exposure to small value stocks and you buy a small value active fund, you may have 20% of the portfolio in large cap growth stocks. So you've lost control because you chose to use an active manager. Now, what most people don't realize is there's even a huge dispersion among similar passive funds. So let me give you an example of this to be helpful. So Vanguard runs a small value fund, and a lot of use Vanguard because they tend to be the cheapest in these factor-based funds. So the Vanguard Small Value Fund, I just checked before our call, has an average market cap of $5.6 billion. Now, that doesn't sound very small to me. Sounds more like a mid-cap fund, right? If you compare that to, say, DFA's Small Value Fund, DFA uses more academic-based definitions, it's about half of that, as is Avantis's fund, which is even a bit lower. DFA has a little under $3 billion. Avantis's small value is $2.5 billion. And if you really want small value, I would look at Bridgeway's fund, which has an average market cap of under $1 billion. So take a look at that. You have $1 billion average market versus, you know, $5.6 billion. They're not similar really at all. You can get big divergences in returns as much as maybe 10% a year based on those differences, right? So that's a problem. And that's why I tell investors there are two tools they can use to be helpful. One, you can go to Morningstar and they have on their site a tab called Portfolio, and it will show you the growth versus value metrics, so things like price to book, price to cash flow. And then they have a market cap tab, and you want the ones that have the most exposure typically to the asset class or risk factor that you want. So that's one tool. The other, as you know, Andrew, and you learned to use the tool at Portfolio Visualizer, that shows you a more technical analysis. And it will show you what's called the loading factor, how much a fund is exposed to that factor. Now, I haven't looked at this in a while, but I would guess Vanguard Small Value Fund may have something like a 0.7 or 0.8 exposure to the size factor, whereas DFA and Bridgeway And Avantis might be very close to one or even higher. I think Bridgeway is over one. And in terms of value, Vanguard may have a 0.5 or a 0.6. And the other three we've been discussing might be 0.8 or 0.9. So if you want exposure, then you want to look at not only the cost of, you know, the expense ratio, but the cost per unit of risk you're getting. So, for example, just to be helpful for everybody here, let's say that one of those three funds, let's just use DFA as an example, has 20% more exposure to the value factor. And let's assume for the moment that you think that value premium is roughly 3% a year. So your expected benefit is very simply 3% times 20% is 60 basis points a year. So the fact that the fund might cost you 20 basis points, you likely would say, I'm willing to pay 20 basis points to get 60 in expected return. Now, if you were paying 50, which is a certainty, you might say, I'm not willing to pay 50 certain to get 60 expected. So this, everybody has to make the decision based upon looking at what they think the loadings are and also the expected risk premium.
Just can you define what you mean by loadings again?
Yeah. So loading is the percentage exposure to that factor. So as we said, Vanguard's small value fund has an average market cap of $5.6 billion. It's not going to have a very large exposure to the size premium. Certainly nowhere near what Bridgeway's fund would be, which if you look at Morningstar, show you has about $900 million versus $5.6 billion. So I'm going to guess, we could look it up, but Vanguard might have a 0.6 or something like that exposure to the size factor. So if you think the size premium is 2%, okay, in there, then that would get you 1.2, 60% of the two, where Bridgeway is, maybe it's 1.1, okay? It's much smaller than that asset class. So 1.1 times 2 is 2.2, and then you look at the difference, and that tells you what the expected return is. And if you look at the history of the funds, and I would urge everybody to look at Morningstar site and look for the years when small value outperformed, and you'll see that Bridgeway's fund would have significantly outperformed, and vice versa. When small value did poorly relative to, say, the S&P, like maybe last year, then Vanguard's fund's going to outperform. It's not that one fund is better than the other. It's that they're different, and you have to decide which one you want. And if you want to look different, well, you should prefer the Bridgeway fund for that reason. So you want to look at these risk-adjusted returns. And it happens virtually every single year, exactly the way I've explained it to you. So 2013, 2016 were big years for value. Small value outperformed. And Bridgeway fund beat the Vanguard fund by, in some of those years, 8 or 10%. In other years, when growth outperformed, the reverse was true.
So can we take a step back and ask a question? What's the best benchmark that we should use for, let's say, small cap?
Yeah. So there really is no right benchmark. It's what exposures you want. So, for example, and let's use small cap. Well, we know there are at least three indices that are pretty popular. There's an S&P 600, which isn't really that small because it also screens for profitability or quality. So it's going to screen out a lot of stuff, which I think is good. And I like that index over others, certainly over the Russell 2000, which is, I think, a poorly designed index. And then you have the MSCI 1750, which does different things. So every investor should look to understand, go to the website, read how they construct their portfolio, what their rules are, and then you can go to an ETF, say, that benchmarks against that, which is, means they're trying to replicate it, okay? You might see an S&P 600 small value ETF, and then run it on Portfolio Visualizer and see what the loadings are.
Yep.
And you can look at Morningstar and see what the metrics are. And then you could decide if that's the right fund for you. I would tell you the S&P and the MSCI indices are far superior to the Russell indices.
So let's talk about that now, just to get down to, you know, what, I don't know what index I should use. You've already described. Well, yes and no, but the S&P 600, what you've said is that it's not a pure small cap index. It's a small cap screen on quality. And did you say something else or just quality?
Quality, profitability, which is sort of kissing cousins. Profitability right. is one of the metrics that makes up the broader category of quality, which includes things like lower volatility of earnings, less financial leverage, things like that.
And I can understand that someone may like that index because it gives you what you could say are the small cap companies that you should invest in. The 600 that they're talking about is out. What is their universe of small caps that they're then applying their screen to? Do you know what that is?
There are 600 stocks in their index that meet certain criteria, and then they choose the ones that are in that value index that you want to look at.
So then let's move now.
The overall 600 is the construction rules. They lay them out
right.
for you. And then they break that up into three categories. The core, meaning all of it, there's a 600 value and a 600 growth.
Okay. So would that mean that what they're talking about is 1,200 stocks that they're looking at?
No, 600 stocks, of which a certain percentage of them will be value and a certain percent will be growth.
Okay. So let's talk about the Russell 2000. You mentioned that it's poorly designed. Roughly, do you know, I remember looking at the Russell when I was young, it was the Russell 5000, but now I see the Russell 5000 doesn't have 5000. But what is your thoughts about the Russell 2000?
Well, I have to remember, I think you're referring to the Wilshire 5000.
Yes, sorry.
So the Russell 2000 is actually the smallest 2,000 of the largest 3,000. And at one point, there were well over 5,000 stocks. So you really weren't very small anyway. You certainly missed all the microcap stocks, which happen to have the highest returns. What the research has shown us is that there are a group of stocks, which we've discussed, that are called lottery stocks. You know, a very small percentage of them go on to do well. Most do poorly. They tend to be small growth stocks with high investment and low profitability. People think they're trying to find the next Microsoft. And that drives up their average prices, and the expected returns then turn out to be very poor. In fact, stocks with those characteristics have underperformed treasury bills. So they're a disaster. And yet, if you buy a Russell 2000 index, you're going to own some of those stocks. So academically based research firms like Dimensional and AQR and Bridgeway and Avantis, they just screen out all of those lottery-like stocks and create their own indices. And S&P 500 or 600 does basically the same kinds of things. So I tell people, again, don't just go by the name. Look at Morningstar. Look at the metrics. Look at the price to earnings, cash flow, price to sales, and book value. Look at the market cap. Go to Portfolio Visualizer. Run the regressions. See what the loadings are. And also see how effective they are at capturing those premiums, because Portfolio Visualizer will also sell you the alpha. Now, you should expect in general, the alpha should be close to zero, probably slightly negative because you have expenses and trading costs. But good design and patient trading can overcome that, and you end up with hopefully close to zero in terms of alphas.
Did I hear you correctly in saying that Dimensional is designing its own index? Is that the case?
And then yeah, they're partnering, or? They design their own benchmarks, or let's call it, they take an asset class, and then based upon their academic empirical research findings, they define their construction rules. So, for example, they may say, we're going to take the bottom 5% of all stocks, that might be for our small cap fund and the bottom 3% for micro caps. But we're not going to buy them all. We're going to eliminate the funds that, you know, have poor profitability characteristics. They also will screen for negative momentum. So if a stock happens to do poorly and becomes a small cap, it was once large or it was once growth and becomes value, they won't buy it when it drops into their index. An index fund would, because it's now in their index and their goal is to match the benchmark. But using the academic research, they found stocks with negative momentum tend to continue to do poorly for some period of time because the market tends to underreact to news. And you also get momentum traders piling in, tax loss selling, driving prices further down till everything is, all the sellers are washed out, if you will. So they wait until that negative momentum ceases, even though it's in their eligible universe, but they screen it out. Similarly, a stock may be doing very well. A small cap stock, let's just make this up, say $1 billion is the maximum they'll buy, but they won't sell until it gets to maybe $1.2 billion. As long as the momentum is positive, they'll let it continue to grow to take advantage of that. And that actually is helpful in two other ways. Can you guess what those two other ways are, Andrew?
I don't know. It's all spinning around in my head right now.
So the same thing works on the negative side. If you're delaying buying, right, when stocks are falling, but you will eventually buy, right, unless it goes bankrupt and keeps falling, and you delay when stocks are going up, you delay selling until that positive momentum ceases or it becomes so big that it doesn't look like your asset class anymore. So you want to get rid of it. What are you doing to your turnover?
You're increasing your turnover.
No, you're decreasing it because you're delaying.
Oh, be delaying.
Buying,
okay, sorry.
Delaying the sale. So delaying turnover, right? Or delaying trading means you're lowering your turnover, which does what to your trading costs?
Should reduce your trading costs.
Reduces your trading costs. You're also now capturing a bit of that momentum factor, which historically has been a premium. And what should that also do to the fund's tax efficiency?
Should improve it, right? We've already said
because
that
you're trading less.
Trading costs and fees, it's one of the most reliable indicators of long-term performance, as I recall.
Exactly. Right. So you get natural benefits besides getting the benefit of, you know, gaining exposure to momentum or at least reducing the exposure to negative momentum, which value tends to have because how do you get to be a value stock? Tends to do poorly. So there are some benefits. So they create their own construction rules. We'll change the subject here, but while we're on it, this is really important issue. So index funds are perfectly okay vehicles. They tend to be very low cost. Competition has driven the cost down to close to zero for a lot of indices, right? But there are some negatives because indices are dumb for the reasons we just described. A stock can, you know, enter an index and it's collapsing, it's doing poorly, and an index fund has to buy it because its sole goal is to match the benchmark and replicate it. And everyone else knows, by the way, all the high-frequency traders like Renaissance Technology are out to screw the index funds. They're going to trade ahead of them and scalp some fees, you know, or spreads out of that. And so the Russell 2000 has far underperformed a very similar CRSP 6 through 10 index in its history. So that's another reason I don't like. So you can be front run there and you are unable to take advantage of being able to trade patiently and to take advantage of momentum. So that's why I don't own any index funds, although I own what I would consider to be passive funds. They're passive in the sense that they define the universe in exactly the same way that the S&P 600 or MSCI 1750. Here's how we define our universe. And they buy and hold anything that's in the universe, but apply these other screens to minimize the negatives or eliminate them of pure indexing, and they screen out stocks where the academic research says have poor returns. So that's why I prefer funds that are not index funds in general, but they are systematic, transparent, so I know exactly what they're doing, and they're replicable. They're not run by humans who are making judgments that can override the machine, if you will, generally, because they think they're smarter than the machine.
I like to call those exposure funds, like they're giving me exposure to that particular element. And
in
from
a
that,
systematic, replicable,
yep,
transparent, because you can buy an active fund that'll give you exposure, but it won't be systematic, it won't be transparent, it won't be replicable, right? And it might depend on if the manager stays or leaves.
So I want to go back to the index. So we've been through the S&P 600, which we've said is not truly just pure small cap because it's screening for quality and profitability. We've talked about the Russell 2000 to say, wait a minute, that's the smallest 2000 of 3000. And as you say, there may be some design flaws, but you know, if you wanted to say, I'm not interested in the largest companies in the market right now, I want to look at the smallest of the 3000. Then we talked, you'd mentioned about the MSCI 1750. What is
that? Right, yeah, the 1750. That's a perfectly good index. I would look at, again, go to a portfolio visualizer, find an ETF that benchmarks that, compare that to the S&P 600 ETFs, compare it to the dimensional Avantis, Bridgeway, BlackRock, you know, any of these systematic vehicles, and then choose the fund that gives you the exposures you want and for relative to the expense ratio. So in other words, I want the deepest exposure I can get, but I have to also be concerned about what the expenses are. So I'm willing to pay for risk exposure. So if Bridgeway costs 2% more, I wouldn't own it. Because if it costs 20 or 30 or something like that basis point and has 60 or 70 or so or 100 basis points in higher expected returns, I'm willing to give that up. And everyone has to make that decision about how much of the guaranteed savings you're giving up to get an expected but not guaranteed higher return. Now, and the other thing is the deeper your exposures, the less you're going to look like the market. So if you're going to be subject to this tracking error, or better stated, tracking variance problem, then own the Vanguard fund because it'll look more like the market. Don't own the Bridgeway fund. But if you want the highest expected returns over the long term, then I would recommend the Bridgeway fund.
Okay. And then, of course, for the listeners and viewers, we're not recommending any specific investment strategy. What we're trying to do is go through, you know, developing knowledge on this. So I went on online right now to look at the MSCI 1750, and it says the smallest 1750 companies in the U.S. investable market, 2,500. So again, it's a little bit, it's like the Russell 2000, where it's the smallest of the biggest. But then I thought, okay, so let's go at this another angle. Let's go look at the VTI fund by Vanguard and see how many stocks are in there. What's its benchmark? And in their case, the benchmark is the CRSP US Total Market Index. And I remember Vanguard switched to CRSP many years ago.
Little cheaper fees than negotiate between CRSP and MSCI and S&P.
And FTSE. And all of them.
And FTSE, yes.
So, but this one is interesting because what it's saying is that the CRSP US Total Market Index is 3,677 stocks. So would we say that that really is the investable universe in the US?
That's the investable public universe in the US. And the MSCI 750, if I remember correctly, you said was the 1750 smallest of the 2,500 largest. So you're entirely missing another 1,200 smaller stocks. And by the way, for your listeners' benefit, all the academic research shows that these factor premiums of size and value, momentum, profitability, quality are much larger in the smaller stocks than they are in the larger stocks where the premiums tend to be small. So that's why my portfolio is 100% small value, because I want the deepest exposure to these factors.
And you say
so I don't look anything like the market, which means that some years I'm going to underperform and in some years I'll outperform. But that's irrelevant to me, that I'm achieving my goal of getting exposure to different factors. I want to look different from the market.
And one of the things that I looked at when I looked at the Bridgeway Small Cap Value Fund is that, well, okay, that's not really small cap either because it's small cap value.
Right. They also run a small cap fund.
Okay.
But I prefer to own small value rather than small cap.
Okay. Just might as well combine those two.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And I think that in the end, you know, what we're talking about is that for a typical investor who really doesn't have time or interest in all that, there's nothing wrong with owning a passive fund that owns the whole market. But if you say, I want to try to enhance my return and my risk adjusted return, then I may decide that rather than just holding the whole market, I'm going to tilt towards factors that you have, you know, taught us have long lasting, you know, premiums, whether that's value. Yeah, historically.
No guarantee on the future.
Yep, that could change. Or also, I think the other way to say that is that there's no guarantee that the next 5 or 10 years is going to be outperformance, but generally they've outperformed over a long period of time. So, Okay.
Yeah, we have 100 years of data basically around the globe and everywhere basically in the world with a few exceptions. All of these factors have delivered performance. Now there are, depending upon the articles you read, somewhere between 400 and 600 factors in the what John Cochran famously called the factor zoo. But that's a gross exaggeration of people, you know, use that to, you know, dampen enthusiasm about factors. The reality is that there's really only about 14, I think. And how do you get then to 400? Because there might be 50 or more value factors. You have price to book, price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to sales, EBITDA to enterprise value, and on and on and on, right? And you have different momentum factors. There are dozens of them, whether you use 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, variations of those things, right? So the studies, everyone is trying to get published. So everyone digs and tries to find enough. But if you not narrow it down, which Andrew Birkin and I did, I think in our seminal book on factor investing called Your Complete Guide to Factor-Based Investing, we think there are only 5 or so equity factors that you really need to consider in the whole factor zoo, meaning market beta, size, meaning small caps, value, momentum, profitability, and quality. And you could kick out profitability if you want, because it's a kind of kissing cousin, as I call it, of quality, meaning profitability is one of the traits of quality. Some of the others include low financial leverage, earning stability. So if you want, you can screen just for small value and quality, and that gets you what you're looking for as well. And so that can make it pretty simple for people. But read my book, and that'll tell you all of the history and the background and get you educated and allow you to make an informed decision.
Well, it's also got a lot of stuff in the back where it goes through specific funds and ideas about allocations and all of that. So I think that's valuable. Well, I want to, just before we move on to the next mistake, I know that Brinson's study was a seminal study, you know, many years ago, talking about the importance of asset allocation. And I wanted to ask a question about this, because sometimes when I read Brinson's work and others talking about allocations, I think to myself, compared to what? I understand asset allocation is important, but what are we comparing it to? What is it better than?
Well, Brinson's study, if I remember, I mean, this goes back now a long time. I haven't looked at it. It could be 20 plus years. But I actually wrote a little piece about it because most people misinterpret Brinson. So Brinson's study didn't say that a portfolio 94 or 93 or whatever the number was, a percentage of the returns are explained by their asset allocation, meaning how much exposure you have to these different factors. He said it explained the vast majority, or 93%, of the variation in returns between portfolios. Okay, that's a difference. There are other studies that show that over 100% of the returns are explained by your exposure, because costs are negative, right? So what's explaining it? It's not stock picking or market timing in general. So you have to understand what we're talking about. The key thing for people to get out of all of this is the academic research shows that active management is a loser's game. What that means is it's just like the roulette wheel, you know, in the casinos in Las Vegas. Can you win? Of course you can. Are the odds in your favor? Of course they're not. And therefore you shouldn't play. And the active management, I call, is a triumph of hope over wisdom and experience. The evidence shows very clearly now that something on the order of 2% of active managers deliver statistically significant alphas, you know, once you adjust for their exposure to these facts. And that's before taxes.
Right.
But once you include taxes, it's probably 1%. I don't know about you. I don't like playing a game where the odds are 98 or 99% against me. Can you win? Sure. But I wouldn't want to take my portfolio, you know, to the lottery off ticket sellers. And I wouldn't want to take it to the active managers either. And so you want to invest systematically, gaining exposure to the factors or asset classes that you think you want in your portfolio to give you unique, different sources of risk. Because remember this, what most people don't know, and there's a wonderful new paper, I just wrote a piece on this, a fellow named McAray wrote a book showing that Jeremy Single was wrong about saying stocks for the long run. And he showed many cases using much better database that even go back into the late 1700s now, where stocks have underperformed bonds around the globe for many decades. And it's really regime dependent. And regimes can last for 20, 30, 40 years. And I'll just give you one.
Who was that, by the way? What was it? It was
McAray is his name. McQuarrie. And I think the name of the paper is it really stocks for the long run? So if you give me a moment, I will let you know. But I know I can give you this one example because I cite it all the time. Investors care about what their investment horizon might be, right?
Yep.
And you could look at, for example, a 40-year period. That's probably longer than many people, right? Certainly, it's longer than your and my investment horizon, right?
Yeah.
And here's a 40-year period from 69 through 08, where large cap growth stocks in the US and small cap growth stocks underperform long-term treasuries, which is the riskless asset for a pension plan with long-term nominal obligations. So that's a problem, you know, for investors. And look at Japan. Now, the U.S., some have said, is the triumph of the optimist. 1989 through 2023. So that's 35 years. Stocks underperformed long-term, you know, the Japanese bond index in both dollar and yen terms. That's 35 years. There's no guarantee that stocks are going to outperform, right?
Yep.
And so you really need to think about diversifying your portfolio. And those periods often value stocks outperform the general, you know, market.
Okay, so let me wrap that up.
And by the way, yeah, sorry to interrupt, but the fellow's name is Edward McAray.
Yep.
And the study is Stocks for the Long Run.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
It was published in the latest issue of the Financial Analyst Journal.
And in fact, if you want to learn more about Edward, you can listen to episode 662, where we talk about his worst investment ever. I haven't seen his latest, so I'm definitely going to go through that, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. So thanks for
Here's one little data point for you. Over the 150 years in the U.S. from 1792 to 1941, stocks and bonds produced virtually the same wealth accumulation. And yet stocks, of course, were dramatically riskier. It was really the next 40 years that gave Siegel the evidence that stocks won in the long term. But since then, stocks have outperformed bonds, but not by much. So from 82 through 2019, when McCray finished his study, that's his last year, their performance was very, very similar. Certainly not enough of a premium to justify the dramatic difference in risks.
So now let's just wrap up by looking at this number 29. Do you believe active management is a winner's game in the inefficient markets? You've already talked about this, but I just was curious about the element that you're talking about, emerging markets, because people are like, okay, but look, emerging markets are still inefficient. I can outperform here in emerging markets. What is the conclusion that you've come to?
Well, it's not a conclusion that I come to. It's a conclusion that the academic research shows. And you can see that every year when Standard & Poor's publishes their annual SPIVA indices, and you will see that over whatever the period, active managers in emerging markets tend to lose. With the longer the horizon, the worse the performance. I just looked up at the end of the year, I write an annual piece that gets into this topic, so I happen to have the data. So what people confuse is they think that the markets in small caps are informationally less efficient because you don't have that many people studying these small stocks in these far-off countries. That may be true. But that's only a necessary condition for active managers to win because active managers may be able to uncover mispricings, but they have to spend money to do it. The question is the market so inefficient that after your costs, not only your expense ratio, but your trading costs, including market impact costs and taxes, and in those countries, you often have taxes on every trade and big bid offer spreads because people are afraid of being exploited by active managers who maybe know more than them. So they make very wide bid offer spreads or only willing to trade a few hundred shares at a time. So when the active manager comes in, they're driving their prices up and down against themselves. So you have to think about, is the market so inefficient that it can overcome costs? So you have to remember, the more inefficient the market is informationally, the greater the costs of exploiting that are almost certain to be. So let's just do a little test. So we have dimensional fund advisors. They are a pure systematic, no fundamental research. They just developed, as we've discussed, their own universe. And let's look at the least efficient of all of these things, which is emerging markets and small. So for the last 15 years, according to the Morningstar data, which is biased against DFA, because it only includes funds that have survived the full period. So that means, you know, most of the funds who don't survive because they did poorly. So they're gone.
So it's biased against survivors or it's biased against DFA.
Yes, it's biased against the survivors.
Okay.
Because I'm just making this up, but maybe today there's only 20 emerging market small funds that have lasted 15 years. Mm. But there may have been 100 that played in that space over that 15. In fact, 7% of all active funds on average disappear every year, and they go to the mutual fund graveyard in the sky, but the returns investors earn live on, right? So how did, if emerging market small cap stocks, which should be the poster child, right, for inefficient markets, if it was true that they were inefficient, DFA should be at least in the bottom half and maybe in the bottom 10%. Because all the active managers can beat them, right? DFA finished in the third percentile, outperforming 97%, even before taxes in the last 15 years. So how people make these statements other than to justify their existence and getting you to believe untruths because they need you to believe that to pay their salaries, the evidence is very clear. It doesn't matter how inefficient the asset class is. In general, the cost of active management is going to be too high. Now, having said that, I'm the first to admit, because the research shows it, as we discussed, there are some anomalies because of dumb, naive investors, these lottery stocks, for example, that people buy. But you can screen them out. You don't have to buy an active manager to avoid them. And there aren't enough dummies in the retail world left to exploit for active managers to make enough to overcome their expenses. There are some, but in general, it's not sufficient. Because most of the time, it's Goldman Sachs trading against Templeton and Morgan Stanley, not against you and me.
Mm. So that's great. You know, when you go back in time, many decades ago, we didn't have these exposure funds or ETFs to say, well, I don't need to invest in your active fund, or I don't need to build my own portfolio of small caps. I can just buy this ETF or fund that's giving me exposure to that factor. But now that's all out there, and it's been out there for many years. So
yes. I would add this, as we've discussed, if you go back 70 or 80 years now, 90% of trading was done by individual investors because they owned all the stock. There was only 100 mutual funds. Okay. Today, you have tens of thousands of mutual funds, and individual investors don't tend to own individual stocks anymore. They've woken up and own mutual funds and ETFs to get the benefits of diversification and avoid all these trading costs, right? Mm. By being a passive investor, they're playing the winner's game. So what that means is 90% of the time when active managers are trading, who are they trading against? People just as smart as them. There aren't enough victims left to exploit for active managers to squeeze out more than a little bit of alpha, but not enough in general to overcome the cost. So if you're going to use active managers, my advice is, one, use people like Vanguard, who, one, don't style drift. So if they tell you they're small value, they're not going to be buying large growth stocks. So find a manager, American Funds, another family, they stick to the nitty. Rule number two, low cost. Active managers don't lose because they're dumb. They lose because they're expensive. And third thing is, turnover matters both for taxes and expenses. So look for low turnover. Guess what the Vanguard funds look like that are active? Low turnover, low expense.
No style drift.
No style drift. And so if you're going to go that route, at least use funds in that category. And then you'll tend to look more like these systematic funds of Dimensional Avantis. I choose to avoid them. I want to use systematic strategies that I know are dependable and I think are more likely to produce better results. But if you're going to go active, go those routes and you'll likely do far better than the average active investor. And you might even approach, or you might get lucky and do better than the systematic funds.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great wrap on a wonderful discussion, you know, about creating, growing, and protecting your wealth. And I've just found it fascinating, a lot of different things that we covered. For the listeners out there who want to keep up with all that Larry is doing, I dare you to do that on Twitter. And you can find him at Larry Swedrow at Twitter. And you can also find him on LinkedIn. This is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stott, saying thank you, Larry, and I'll see you all on the upside.